Hey everybody, this is Cody, and you are listening to the Cantus Firmus podcast. I'm going to talk to you today a little bit about the Book of Daniel and the issues related to its authorship and date and all that kind of stuff. So a lot of folks are familiar with the story of Daniel in the lion's den. Slightly less of us are familiar with the story of his friends Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, if only because of the Beastie Boys song. But I'd like to go into the much less familiar territory of how Daniel is dated by critical scholars who question the Bible's truthfulness, veracity, and to show how those arguments are rebutted by conservative scholars. And when in this field, conservative just means a biblical scholar who reads the Bible as ultimately trustworthy. So let's start by saying that the Book of Daniel claims to have been written during the exile of the Jews after the Babylonian invasion of Jerusalem. And it goes into the as well into the period of the Empire of the Medo-Persians, who conquered Babylon. And that would put its final date of composition around 530 BC. This date is contested by critical scholars for a handful of reasons, but the most pertinent ones have to do with the fact that Daniel claims to know about future events, which he delivers information about through prophetic oracles. If you think the Bible is trustworthy in its relation of supernatural events, this won't be a very persuasive argument for you. But if you rule out the supernatural a priori, which is to say as a basic presupposition before any evidence is brought out, then obviously Daniel must have been written after the events he claimed to prophesy about, because prophecy isn't a meaningful category in philosophical kind of naturalism. But what are the prophecies in Daniel that critics use to date it? Well, in chapter 8, Daniel has a vision of a ram with two horns fighting a goat with one large horn. The two-headed ram is explicitly identified in the text as the dual kingdom of Medo-Persia. Thus, two horns. That's Media and Persia. And the goat is identified as Greece, which is a kingdom coming from the west that conquers everything in its path, including the ram. This implies that the goat's one big horn is Alexander the Great. We then read that, quote, the goat became very great, but at the height of its power, the large horn was broken off, and in its place, four prominent horns grew up toward the four winds of heaven. We know that Alexander's kingdom was divided into four, and that one of those kingdoms, the Seleucid kingdom or empire, would have a huge impact on the Jewish people. This is where the critical scholarship date comes in. Daniel says that one of the four horns grows in power and directs itself toward Palestine. It then takes the horn then takes away the temple sacrifices and worship. And the historical personages that this is consistent with is Antiochus IV, called Epiphanes. His name means God manifest. In addition, the Epiphanes does. In addition, Daniel 11 has a lot of very specific biographical details about Antiochus's life. Though from verses 36 to 45, it either shifts to describing a different king, which some exegetes have identified as Antichrist, or it begins to give incorrect data about Antiochus's life just before his death. Critical scholars opt for the latter interpretation, that Daniel is writing at the time of Antiochus's life and doesn't know how he's going to die, or the so-called Daniel. So he sort of invents an end for him. And as a result of that, they date the writing of Daniel to just before the book begins to give that data, which they view as false prophecy. This would place Daniel at around 167 BC. So, you know, a good deal later, let's just say, about almost 400 years later. So the problem with this reading of Daniel is that Daniel doesn't just provide data up to the time of Antiochus, but also up to the time of Christ. In Daniel's second and seventh chapters, we find two different accounts of the same series of events, which were yet future to Daniel. The first from the perspective of the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar. And the second vision, in Daniel 7, comes more or less from the perspective of God. In chapter 2, We read of Nebuchadnezzar's dream of a great statue with four different parts made of different elements, all representing four kingdoms. The first, the head and the shoulders, if I recall, is the Babylonian Empire. The second part is the Medo-Persians, the third, the Greeks, and the fourth, the Romans. In the end, a stone cut without human hands is hurled at the feet, and the image comes crashing down. It would be during this fourth empire, the Roman, that God's kingdom would be inaugurated, according to Daniel 2. In chapter 7, we see this from God's perspective. These pagan powers were not a beautiful statue, as Nebuchadnezzar saw them, but crude beasts, which will be judged in God's coming kingdom on earth. Critical scholars reinterpret the beasts and the statue to make the fourth kingdom Greece instead of Rome, so that their version of Daniel isn't writing about future events, but present-day events. The problem with that interpretation is that the third beast is clearly Greece, and it matches many of the characteristics of the goat in Daniel chapter 8, which actually is explicitly identified as Greece. Instead of a swift goat, in Daniel 7, we actually read about this beast being is a leopard. A leopard is swift, just as the swift goat is, and this leopard has four heads and four wings, which is reminiscent of Daniel's description of the leopard as, quote, crossing the whole earth without touching the ground, unquote, thus the wings, before its horn is broken, and four new horns grow in its place. So it seems pretty clear from the context that the Greece is that third kingdom, and Daniel's envisioning a fourth kingdom, which comes after. In addition, in Daniel chapter 9, Daniel has a vision where he sees that 490 years after the call to rebuild the Jerusalem temple, a Messiah will come and be put to death in order to, quote, finish transgression, put an end to sin, atone for wickedness, bring in everlasting righteousness, seal up vision and prophecy, and anoint the most holy place. It's Daniel 9:24, if you want to look it up. The timing of this prophecy results in an end date at around 27 AD, which is the beginning of the ministry of Jesus. Add this to Daniel's claim that at the time of the Fourth Empire, Rome, God's kingdom would be inaugurated, a prophecy that was fulfilled by Christ's resurrection and the church which it created. There are other problems, though, with dating Daniel to the 160s BC. Stephen Miller, in his commentary on Daniel, gives us one example, and it underlines the special pleading and circular reasoning of the critical perspective. Critical scholars had suggested that a number of psalms probably dated to the time of Antiochus IV, but this hypothesis was broadly abandoned when manuscripts of these psalms were found at Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls, also known as, which dated to the late 2nd century BC. Writes Miller, W.H. Brownlee remarks that, quote, it would seem that we should abandon the idea of any of the canonical psalms being of Maccabean date, for each song had to win its way in the esteem of the people before it could be included in the sacred compilation of the Psalter. Immediate entree for any of them is highly improbable, unquote for Brownlee. Yet concerning Daniel, Brownlee states, quote, none of the Dead Sea Scroll copies of Daniel are so early as to dispute the usual critical view concerning the book's authorship, although one Daniel manuscript from Cave 4 is to be dated not more than 50 years later than its composition, end quote. For Brownlee, if the discovery of the Psalter in the 2nd century BC is sufficient evidence to push the date of that document back before 332 BC, should not the same evidence indicate that Daniel was written before the 2nd century, end quote on Stephen Miller. Such fuzzy reasoning and double standards on the part of critical scholars led Old Testament scholar Brevard S. Childs to remark, quote, the often used cliche of freedom from dogma seems now largely rhetorical, nor can the categories of historical versus dogmatic be seen as intractable rivals. Rather, the issue turns on the quality of the dogmatic construal. It is undoubtedly true that in the history of the discipline, traditional dogmatic rubrics have often stifled the close hearing of the biblical text. But it is equally true that exegesis done in conscious opposition to dogmatics can be equally stifling and superficial. End quote. When you assess all the data on the Book of Daniel, it's clear that the critical perspective tries too hard to come up with a naturalistic explanation for its composition that simply strains plausibility.